This is a message from Acast.
Live at the London Podcast Festival, King's Place, London!
From fish to feminism, cows to comedy, the very best of podcasting is coming to King's Place in London this September. The 7th annual London Podcast Festival will feature live episodes of hit shows including the Adam Buxton Podcast, The Guilty Feminist, No Such Thing as a Fish, The Beef and Dairy Network, as well as podcasts from Jamila Jamil and James A. Acaster. The festival runs from the 8th until the 19th of September and tickets are on sale now. Head to kingsplace.co.uk for the full lineup.
Soccer writers provide an interesting insight on the game that more often than not we watch on TV. Sure, we can see players doing certain formations, running certain plays and stuff like that, but sometimes a deeper look for things that might not necessarily be on the pitch is almost necessary to understand what we're seeing. So today we're going to revisit an interview I had with John Nicholson, who is a writer, a novelist, and pretty much everything of the sort, and we're going to get into a little bit more about that, but a lot of John's famous books, such as We Ate All the Pies or Can We Have Our Football Back, are great-selling works, and he gains a lot of support in terms of his sales and his audience that follows him now. But outside of writing nonfiction extended works, he also has news and blogs for Football 365, which just provides his insights on the game as a whole. But as I already mentioned, he's much more than a soccer writer. He's also a t-shirt salesman. He helps with a rock and roll website, and we're going to get into that more into our conversation. So hope you all enjoy, and make sure to follow John Nicholson on Twitter at JohnnyTheNick. He's a great guy to follow and a great writer to read as well. John, so like I already mentioned, you kind of expose yourself to a lot of different outlets. Could you just bullet list, what are the various things that people might find you doing on any given day?
Well, it's a varied day every day. My primary writing role is as a football writer for Football 365 and for the Irish Examiner, who I do a weekly thing for. So I'm writing sort of 4 days a week about football. Also in those days, I am running T-Shirts 365, which is a football T-shirt website, and DJT's, which has been going for 21 years now, and we design rock T-shirts. So those things all happen concurrently, really, with all of that. On top of that, my partner, Dawn, is an artist. So we run websites which sells her art as well. And so there's all of that to update too. And if I've got any spare time, I also write novels and football books. So, and I've just published the latest one, Was Football Better in the Old Days? So there's a lot of things going on all the time. And I work sort of 12, 14 hour days almost every day. I'm not one for sitting watching TV, and you know, I say work, but it's not really work in the sense of it being something I hate doing. It's something I'm really passionate about. So, you know, I'm in a very fortuitous position really to get paid to do something I love. And I've been doing that for 21 years now.
So all the football writing you do, you say you don't watch too much TV, but I think a lot of the time, at least for my side of it, inherently we have to watch TV in order to watch certain games. So is that true for you and the fact that you do have to watch games, or is your writing more of just analyzing other kinds of things or editorial pieces on things that don't necessarily involve results or anything of that sort?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually, because I do watch games on TV, or at least I have them on while I'm doing writing or whatever it is else I'm doing. But a lot of my writing isn't so concerned with the day-to-day of football. I feel as if there are loads of writers, fantastic writers, who analyse football in a kind of granular detail. And that's not really my gig, really. You know, the whole thing with tactics and positions and everything to do with the kind of granular detail of football is something I think is well covered. So I tend to write more about cultural issues around football, about it's stories and issues and problems that come up because of football, you know, around ownership, around finance, around things like mental health, misogyny and things like that. I mean, I write about all of those things, really. I mean, Sarah, my editor, often says I'm the only football writer who doesn't write about football. And there is some element of truth in that, really.
Right. Yeah. So, but outside of football writing, correct me if I'm wrong, you're also a mystery writer. And how do you mix those in? How do you go from writing about football and the things outside of the game itself, and then switching over and pivoting to mystery writing, which, at least from my perspective, doesn't really have too many relationships with it?
Well, interestingly enough, the crime novels that I write are all of the same three central protagonists in each of them. And Nick, my sort of main guy, is a Middlesbrough fan, like me, is my age, and has an enormous record collection, just like me. So I find it quite easy to slip into his character to write things. But you're absolutely right. It's a wholly different discipline, writing about football and the issues around football, than it is making up stories. It's like it uses an entirely different muscle. And some days, and I'm going through this a little bit at the moment, I just can't get writing the story. I'm in too much of a kind of factual delivery mode. And when you're in that sort of sensible mode, it's very hard to, I find, to tap into the creativity that you need in order to manufacture stories and characters and speech and all of this. It's very much a kind of different discipline. And so sometimes flipping between the two is really tricky. I've got a bit of writer's block at the moment, which is the first time it's happened to me in 12 years. And I just feel as though what I'm trying to do to write through it, I'm trying to write scenes for the new book, for the new novel. And later I'll stitch them all together. But I'm just writing scenes that I'm really interested in writing, you know, trying to get through it in that sense. But novel writing is really strange because it's a discipline which is very creative. You obviously have to dream up stories, characters, and interrelate them all. But it is also very practical in that you have to have a plot that goes from A to B to C to D. And so you have to be very disciplined. And once you've written the story, you have to go back and make sure it all justifies itself. And it isn't just, there isn't any enormous holes in the plot. Which, I mean, I was watching something a while ago, and there was a huge hole in the plot in the story, in the movie. And I thought, surely somebody must have spotted that. And that's the thing that terrifies me most of all, is that the fact I've asserted something, but I haven't justified it with the rest of the plot in the book. Mm-hmm. So it's hard work doing all of that stuff, actually. That's the real kind of meat and potatoes of fiction writing, I find.
Yes, sir.
I do bring football into the stories as well sometimes.
Okay, so there you go. So how'd you get into mystery writing? Was it always just like a hobby of yours that you decided to take a little bit further? Or was it something that you realized one day, like, I want to try something different, let me try doing this instead?
Well, what happened was in 2012, me and Don sold DJTs. That left us with about £500,000. And we just thought we'd take about 5 years off and develop other careers. And that's what we did. We developed a separate writing career, our fiction writing career. And Don's really got established as an artist. And that's how it all started. Now, at the time, in 2012, 2013, I think this was probably because I was 49, 50 at the time. I developed an incredible depressive period where I was really, really depressed for about 6 to 8 months. Much of the time, I didn't really realize how depressed I was. And that was one of the motivations for starting writing, was because I wanted to kind of do self-therapy, which sounds a bit weird and a bit narcissistic, but I just wanted to know why I had this enormous black hole in my existence. And while I felt as if I was peering into the void, and it was a nameless sort of almost physical pain of melancholy. And writing the books helped me get through that. I wrote the first three, which was Teesside Steel, Queen of the Tees, and Teesside Mist. I wrote all of those straight off the bat, three in about 9 months. And I was just pouring out of me. And I released them as a trilogy altogether, because I run a publishing company as well. I forgot to tell you about that. I run Head Publishing, which is a publishing company we set up just to publish my work, essentially. And I released those three together. And they immediately took off, and they were really popular. I mean, relatively popular, at least, I should say. I don't want to make great claims to them, but they sold a few thousand copies. And because that we were publishing them, we weren't just getting a royalty, we were getting the cost after production, which on a sort of 9 quid book is about £6, £6.50. So it actually proved quite lucrative quite early on. And I suddenly thought, because all this lovely positive vibes is coming in, I could obviously do this, you know. And now it took me a long time to get over it, the imposter syndrome of being a writer, because the time I grew up in and where I grew up, people like me weren't writers. And I know it sounds silly to say it, but it's just like, it felt like it wasn't me. I felt like I was a fake writer all the time. Even like going back 20 years ago when I started on Football 365, I thought I would get found out at some point that I wasn't really a writer at all. I was just bluffing it, you know. And it literally took me until about 2016, 2017 to really finally get over that. And I thought, you know, I've now written 20 books. So if I'm not a writer, I don't know who the hell is, you know. So, you know, I finally did get over it. But it was a long walk, that, man. It really was, you know.
So that moment of realizing that you overcame that imposter syndrome, it really was just like a moment where you had some kind of realization. It wasn't just like something that you slowly gradually came. It was just like pop, and then you realize, you know, I am doing this, and here I am. I'm an actual writer, and people love my work, as you say. I mean, you sold thousands of copies of your books.
Yeah, it was a sort of gradual process, I suppose, actually, but more just simply out of the fact that people treated me as though I was a writer, and at some point it just dawned on me in about 2016 that. You know, if I call myself a writer, I'm not fooling anybody. That is what I do. I'm aware that that does sound rather a bit pathetic, really. But I think a lot of people who come from working class or underprivileged backgrounds do feel this imposter syndrome. You feel as if it's not the sort of thing that people like me do. And I hope the future generations don't feel like that in the same way, because it is very debilitating, really, and it limits what people can do, because they just think, well, it's that isn't a profession that I've seen people like me do, you know. I once went into, in connection to working on the novels, I went into a jail in Stockton, where I grew up. I grew up in Stockton, not in the jail. And and asked to talk to prisoners about writing. And it was a really eye-opening experience, because all of them were from very dodgy backgrounds. I mean, there were some really bad people there. I don't hesitate to say that. But it was really fascinating, because none of them realised that their life stories, which had led them to this point in jail, and we haven't got time to go into it here, but some fantastic stories. I mean, really funny stories as well. I had their life of crime had ended up in jail. And I said to them, look, if you were to write all of this into a story, into a novel, this is what people want to read, because you've done things that people don't do. You know, you've experienced a part of life that most people don't experience. And there was two lads that were in there. I mean, obviously the reading age amongst them is about age 8 or 9. I mean, this was part of a literacy course, in fact. But the two lads who were the most articulate have actually gone on to write. Whether as a consequence of what I said, I don't know, but apparently they have had things published. And I think there's a great untapped well of creativity amongst people who aren't traditionally the kind of people who write books, you know? And you do, obviously lots of working class people do get through, you know, people like Martina Cole, but we never know how many people are put off by the whole middle class, what I call the linen suit, arts kind of elite, who are just very, very not people like me. I can't tell you how not like me they are. So, you know, and in fact, I often don't even respect you, really, because you're not part of their gang. So, you know, I think we lose a lot of creativity from the working class because of that, because people just get put off, it gets strangled at birth, you know?
Mm-hmm. So flipping back to football and that era, or that side of writing, when did you start getting into that? Was that something that you always wanted to do when you were younger? And obviously everybody that watches the sport growing up says, I want to do something related to that in the future. So is that true for you, and the fact that you wanted to write about football or anything like that?
Yeah, it started really. I started doing it for money in 2000, November 2000. But it started about 5 or 6 years earlier when I read Harry Pearson's book, The Far Corner. Now, Harry is from the same part of the country that I'm from. He's from Great Ayton near Middlesbrough, which is about 8-10 miles away from where I grew up. And his writing in that really was so, it expressed so much about my life with football, both the culture of football and actual football itself, and the dissonance he felt between having growing up from a working class background, but now being essentially having a middle class lifestyle. And that expressed so much my kind of experience in life. The one particular part in the book where he's eating alfalfa sprouts in a sandwich going to a game, that perfectly expressed that kind of those two worlds rubbing up against each other. And I thought, I'd love to do that. I'm sure I could do that. And that was really what sparked my interest in that. Now, from that point, I wrote several things that never got published in the sort of mid-90s. And then it kind of felt went on the back burner a bit. But then Football 365 started up in 1997. And I used to write in letters. They used to have a letters page way back then. I used to write in letters. And Steve Anglesey, who was the editor at the time, really liked them. And long story short, they offered me a column. And that just evolved into doing 3 pieces a week. And that's how I got started. And I will forever be grateful to Steve and to his kind of further up the chain was Howard Johnson. And who I still, actually, it's another thing strung to my bow I forgot to tell you about. I actually work for a rock magazine called Rock Candy Magazine. I do all their social media and I write pieces for them occasionally as well. That's about rock and metal of the 70s and 80s, essentially. And Howard's the editor of that, because he moved on from football. So it's all a bit nepotistic in that way. But yeah, and they gave me a chance. And I just said, write what you want to write. I mean, you know, you could. And in fact, to this day, in 21 years of writing for them, nobody's ever said to me, Sarah, the editor who's been editor now for almost all of that time, has never said to me what I should write or what I shouldn't write. They've all just said, write what you want to write. And I just, that's an incredible privilege to be able to do that. You know, I don't think many people have that degree of freedom, really, you know?
So the writing what you want to write, that for you, at least for Football 365, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is issues or any kind of problems outside of what we see on the pitch. So it could be things related to man or you know, ownership or any kind of scandals, issues of that sort. Why do you write about those things as opposed to results? Is it just because, you know, the results are something that we see all the time and you want to do something different? Or did you find interest in the things that happen behind the scenes?
Yeah, I mean, it's twofold, really. Firstly, I felt as if, and I've always felt like this, that there are a lot of people doing versions of match reports. So there are people analysing games, analysing tactics, what happened when, to whom. And I didn't really want to get into all of that because I think I enjoy I used to flippantly call it the making up things side of writing. In other words, not being so confined to the facts as stated, you know, Jones scored in the 84th minute, you know. I like the idea of thinking things up and working up ideas and philosophies, if you like. And Football 365 has been brilliant for letting me do that. I mean, you know, I like to think that even now I bring something that other people don't bring to it, and it fills a gap that would not be filled otherwise. And but I think more than that is what really interests me and has always interested me, and this only really became obvious to me later in life, was it I've loved about football isn't the actual football so much as everything that goes around it. So like when I was a kid and I'd go to the Borough, I loved the whole thing about going and the traveling there, being in the crowd, standing on the hall gate, all of that and experiencing what that was like. Obviously couldn't happen without the football, but it was 50% of the experience. And so I've sort of took that thing into my writing, really. I mean, all through the 80s and 90s, I would listen to lots of football-related programs, 606 on, like phone-ins on Radio 5 Live, and lots of different things. And that always interested me. Talking about the game always really interested me more than analysing the game, if you see what I mean. And I think when I came to be a professional writer, professional football writer, that was quite a natural pocket for me to inhabit, really. You know, it wasn't sort of something I had to force. It came very naturally. It was obviously my It was my instinct to do it like that, really, especially as I got a little bit older. My early years of writing were far more, wild and strange. There were some very strange things happened, largely due to my levels of intoxication at the time. But like certainly for the last 10, 12, 13 years, you know, I think as I've grown older, I think the cultural issues around football are such both reflect societal things that are happening, but also often a driver of certain things too, a driver for change or for reaction reasons. So it's really, yeah, I think it's very innate to me now. You know, it really is. And I still, even now after 21 years writing three pieces a week, I still love it. I said to Sarah the other day, she said, if you ever want to have a day off, I've never not filed a copy, never missed a deadline. I tell the story that in 2006, I was traveling through the Nevada desert on an Amtrak, and we broke down outside of Reno. And I was standing in the middle of the in the Mojave Desert with a phone, trying to get a connection to upload my article to Sarah back in London, as it was at the time. And I was so dedicated to getting it done. You know, I've always felt it was a huge privilege. I never wanted to abuse it. So like even now, she says to her sometimes, you know, could just take a Wednesday off, don't do something. But as I always say, the river always seems to flow past my door. I've always got something to say, something I want to write, you know. And so it's never really a struggle. I actually feel generally in life, as the life of a writer, if writing, whatever it is you're writing, is really difficult, it's probably not for you. It should be quite easy to get it out. Harder to get it to be really good, mm-hmm. really hard to be really good. But to get something out and down, that should be quite easy. You know, I don't know if that's a controversial view, but it's, I always find all the things that I struggle with are things that I'm no good at writing. So don't do it, you know?
Mm-hmm. So before we get into the items that I've asked you to bring in, you mentioned that your days are consistently 12 to 14 hour days. I think that might surprise a few people, especially considering that people might think of writers as they just sit down, write, bang out a story or two, and then call it a day. But for you, what does a 12 to 14 hour day consist of on average?
Okay, well, I will get up at about, these days, it's about 7 o'clock. Because I'm sober these days, so it's now 7 o'clock, and I will do if it's a day before my Monday piece will be written on a Sunday, so I'll spend 2 or 3 hours writing that, sometimes a bit longer. I will spend 2 or 3 hours doing all of my media posts for Rock Candy magazine, and it depends what other sort of work is on at that time. There may be some design work to do or some admin. So I've got to do the accounts and stuff like that too. I will do 2 or 3 hours in an evening writing on a book if I've got a book on the go, which I usually do have. So I tend to do it in 2 or 3 hour blocks, and then I try to get up and go somewhere and go walking out here in the woods at the back of the house, just to try and break the day up a bit, because otherwise you're just sitting on your backside for literally like 10 hours not moving, and that's not healthy. So I tend to do 2 or 3 hour blocks, give it a rest, watch a game or listen to something, whatever it is, and then go back to it.
All right. So, John, like I said, I did ask you to bring in a couple of things. I was wondering if you had any of those on hand for you or for me right now.
Oh, right. I don't.
Oh, really?
I've got one thing I wanted to show you. As I said to you in the email, I don't have photos and things,
yeah,
or any memorabilia really as such. I just have books and stuff. So, but I have my certificate anyway, come back. Hold this thought.
Will do.
Right. I'll just show you that. Now, this is my award for being nominated for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year 2010 for my book, We Ate All the Pies. And that is one of my proudest possessions. Because, you know, we were talking about imposter syndrome. And that was one of the things that helped me start to believe I could be a writer. Because it was the first book I'd ever produced. And it's basically about the culture of football and why we love it so much. It's about, as I was saying before, it's about the 50% of football that isn't the actual kicky-kicky, you know? And because that had been longlisted for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year, which was and still is a really prestigious prize, it meant that independent people, a panel of people independently, had judged it as being worthwhile. Of all the hundreds of books that had been published that year, that mine was one of the best ones. And when you have imposter syndrome, I can't tell you how important it is for people who have no vested interest in liking your work actually say they like it. It's an amazing feeling. And that really filled in a lot of my insecurities. That really was that was the first time, although it was some years later before I really self-identified as a writer, that was what set me on the path to doing it. So it's a really important thing because of that. So they sent me a certificate. They even framed it for me. So that was nice. And I still have it on my wall and in my writing areas. So I still treasure it, even though it is now 11 years ago.
For those that may not be aware, what is the premise of We Ate All the Pies, and just in general, like what could people learn or gather from reading that?
Well, the subtitle is How Football Swallowed Britain Whole. And what I did in it really was to try and see why football is the most popular sport. What is it that holds us to it, even despite a lot of times falling out of love with it? Why do we keep coming back for more? What is it that ties us to the sport? And why do we feel so passionately about it? And this was actually something I picked up in my latest book, which is called Was Football Better in the Old Days? And that actually, these two things kind of like are the bookends of the same story in some ways. And my sort of conclusions about it all, and I think that this is probably what most people feel, even if they don't really realize they do, is that football gives us a community and it gives us self-identity. And very other few things in life can do that so effortlessly for the price of a ticket, you know, or for watching something on the TV. And it gives us a kind of structure to life as well. And I feel as if life, I mean, this is just my perspective on it, but to me, life feels very chaotic. I fear things getting out of control all the time. So it isn't as though I feel on top of everything. I think this is partly because I'm a writer and because I spend all my days just thinking things up. So I don't, no one's ever telling me what to do. I've never had a job where I've worked for somebody on anything other than a freelance basis. So I've never had to go into an office and do a job. And that is, now I'm 60, that's quite a long time. So I fear chaos, and football gives me a kind of skeleton upon which to hang my life. And I think that's the same for a lot of people. You know, that's the beauty of the 3 p.m. on Saturday kind of tradition, is that you always know where you were. You know, you always know where you should be. Yeah. I wake up in the morning, I don't know what day it is. And the first thing I do is I think back to what was the game last night. So that yesterday when I woke up, I thought, hang on, what was on last night? Oh yeah, Champions League, Wednesday. So this today must be Thursday. And this morning I woke up, think Europa League, it's Thursday, you know. So it does really give you a structure, which is really important, I think, in life, to give life some kind of direction. Otherwise, you're just drifting around. And this is why when the football season closes, some like really mad football people like me feel rather bereft, because we don't what we're supposed to do. You know, the structure's all gone. You know, you're looking for the fixture list to give your life some meaning back again. So,
yeah.
So that, I mean, so the whole book was about these aspects, cultural aspects, really, of life, you know, and I dealt with things like memorabilia and football strips, how they are, how they tie us to supporting the club. You know, as Jerry Seinfeld once said, ultimately we're just supporting laundry because everybody else goes. It's only the shirt that remains. And I looked at things like food through the ages, of things that sold at football, all sorts of different stuff, and TV and how it's covered and everything. And all of these things go together to bind us to the game in a way that I think we take so for granted. A lot of time we don't even realize it. So that's why I wrote the book, to try and unpack it all, if you like.
You talk about how it provides structure, football does, but I think it also provides, like you said, a sense of community. and it's just a part of our lives growing up into when we get older. So I want to ask you personally, is there any moment watching the game or anything like that where you realized how much you love the sport, and or is there like a moment where you were at a game that just stuck with you for whatever reason?
Well, that the most incredible football experience I had was when Middlesbrough were playing in the UEFA Cup, and we got to the final, if you remember, in 2006. Along that way, in the knockout games of that tournament, we lost one leg of every knockout leg. So we had to come back from behind all the time. We always lost one of the legs, still got to the final. And the second time that happened initially in the round of the quarterfinals against Basel. And we came back and won 4-2 at home. And then against Steaua Bucharest when we came back and won 4-3 at home. That second one against Steaua Bucharest is the most transcendent moment of my football life. And something really weird happened that day. And you've got to remember, I'm a bit of an old head. So when you think about how I think about these things, but I don't know if you ever had this experience, but when you are watching a game, you suddenly go forward in time by about 1 or 2 seconds. You know what's going to happen. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. Well, when Macaroni scored the fourth goal for Borough that day in the 89th minute, I saw Downing cross that ball, and I knew it was going to be a goal before it was a goal. And I was up celebrating that goal before Macaroni did it. It was like a diving header to head it in. And it was just so obvious to me that that was going to happen. And it's like a form of time travel. You go forward by about 2 seconds, and then reality catches up, and then it's goal. And that was just the most intense thing. I mean, I know that sounds very trippy and cosmic, but that was really much how it felt. And also that communal experience when a whole ground knows what's going to happen. Like we were 2-0 down at home after being 1-0 down after the first leg. We had to score 4 goals to go through. By the time we scored the third goal, everybody assumed we would get 4. I mean, everybody. Nobody thought that, oh, we'll just fall short. Even our traditional cynicism as Borough fans had evaporated. And I think then we got to the 89th minute and thought, well, we are going to score. Surely we are going to score. And of course we did. And so, I mean, I think that game for a lot of Middlesbrough fans would be the one that they always went back to. I mean, we won the League Cup in 2004. That was brilliant. But somehow this was so intense. And the fact that it happened twice in a row, man, that was a special day. That was the final for us when we lost. We got beat 4-0 in the final, but it didn't kind of matter because we'd sort of won anyway, you know? So mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a golden moment, man.
Yeah, no doubt. You already talked about how Jerry Seinfeld mentioned, you know, we're all supporting laundry. And yeah. That kind of applies to you. You have the t-shirt company. How do you get into that? Going from a writer, a football writer, and then Mr. Writer later, how do you start being going into the t-shirt industry?
Well, that's related to Football 365 as well. So we go back to the year 2000, and Football 365 wanted to open a shop selling football-related memorabilia. I said that we would design some t-shirts. So we did, and we mocked them up. I took them down to show them to Howard and Steve, and they were all for it. So with me and another lad called Dave Tarbox, we started to design shirts for Football 365, and they were sold on the website. And it did quite well. In fact, it did very well, particularly at Christmas, for about 2 years. And towards the end of that period of time, Dawn had said to me, look, we should do this ourselves, and not working for somebody else. Because we would just get a small cut of every sale. We should set up our own site and you know, do it for ourselves. I said, yeah, but, you know, I don't know. What should we do? You know, what we're going to sell, you know? And she said, well, you know loads about rock music because I'm a huge record collector. I've got a huge album collection of vinyl. And she said, you know everything there is to know about rock music, so why don't we do it on rock music? So long story short, that's what we did. Started in October 2002. And I think to date we have sold about, I think I did a rough guesstimate on it, I think we've sold about 3.5 million shirts since then. So it's incredible. We've had our ups and downs, believe me, as anybody that stayed with us in Las Vegas in 2009 can attest. We have gone off the rails several times. What we did was when we sold it in 2012, we sold it on a kind of installment basis to this other guy. And it turned out that after about across 5 years, but he turned out he couldn't pay all of them. He paid about three quarters of it. And for reasons that are too complicated to explain, he couldn't pay the rest of it. So in under the terms of our contract, it fell back to me and Dawn to take ownership of it again. So we did that in about 2018. Yeah, February 2018. And we just relaunched it all and still doing it now. Yeah, so it's right. It's an interesting business to be involved in because it's obviously plugged into one of my major passions in life. But also, you can do it at home. We don't have to leave the house to make a living. So in the recent, with the pandemic, that's been extremely useful, you know?
And then going back to writing, you say you always have a book that you're kind of working on or just, you know, getting going. Is there anything you got working right now that you've been working on for a little bit?
I've started the 16th Nick Gaimer book. That's my character. So I'm just, as I say, I'm getting a little bit of writer's block on that at the moment, but I've got about 10,000 words of that done. I think that'll see the light of day in the spring. I just finished, just published about a month ago, Was Football Better in the Old Days, or Is Now Better Than Back Then? And there was a long birth of that because it took me quite a while through the pandemic and everything to get that all together. But I was quite pleased with that. So my sort of next 2 or 3 months will be spent promoting that. I should have a copy of it here to show you, but of course I don't because I'm not professional like that. but I could get one. But so that's essentially what I'll be. I mean, this is the weird thing about being a kind of one-man band with publishing your own work and such. I mean, it's quite commonplace now for people to self-publish. Probably when we started doing it about 10 years ago, it was less so. But I've always gone about it in a very as professional way as I could. So I have an editor who I pay to edit the books. And I have proofreaders who I pay to proofread the books. And Robert, my editor, is actually American. He lives in Ohio, though he's a big Anglophile. And he really keeps me on the straight and narrow with everything. You know, he knows all of the things to do with punctuation that I never paid attention to in class. So he keeps me right from that perspective. So we work together quite closely on things. I will submit a first draft to him and he'll have a look it over and he'll say, this bit's not no good, you should get rid of that bit. He says, you've gone off the rails here. You're swearing too much at this point. Well, why have you put sex in here? You don't need sex in here. So he's good. He's like a kind of benevolent father, really. So, yeah. But and there's always something on the go, man. Always something. I mean, if I've got space, I will fill it, you know. That is my kind of motto in life.
John, really appreciate you coming on. I'll wrap up with this. You mentioned Football 365. Where else can people find what you're doing or where they can find any of your various kinds of work?
Okay, well.
I know there's a long list to choose from, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I've got half an hour. Go to find any of my books is johnnicholsonwriter.co.uk. And all of my current work, all the works I've ever published are all there. And obviously Football 365 on Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays, you'll find my stuff. If you want football t-shirts, it's t-shirts365.com or music shirts, which is djts.com. And if you want to read my posts for Rock Candy magazine, just look for Rock Candy magazine on Facebook. And everything that's on the Facebook page all comes out of my head. And you'll see me having photos of me holding up obscure albums from 1973 that nobody else has heard of, but which I recommend to people. So I do all of that side of things as well. So, yeah, I'm all over everywhere. You can't escape me, man. I'm like the wind, just everywhere.
All right, John. Well, I really appreciate you coming on, and I wish you the best going forward and all those different ventures you got going on.
Oh, thanks, man. That's kind of you. Nice to speak to you.
Yeah, for sure. Have a good one.